From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's time to harvest apples. Michigan growers worry, are there enough workers?
We got some that may not be coming back. We have absolutely zero people coming by looking for work like they used to a few years back.
New M-STEP proficiency scores are out.
So when 45 states are doing better than us in any given subject area, what are they doing that's working? And how can we bring that to Michigan students?
In the debate over mental health funding, a call to remember just who is most important.
These are our friends, our neighbors, our mothers, our fathers, our sisters, our brothers that are deserving of being treated with dignity and respect and getting the care that we would want for somebody we love.
And the mom who turned to panhandling to raise her daughter's college tuition. Those stories and more on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Scores for the 2017 M-STEP proficiency exams are out. The Michigan Student Test of Educational Progress replaced the old MEEP test in 2015. It's administered online to most students in Michigan and designed to measure their knowledge in math, science, social studies, and English language arts. And results of the 2017 test are mixed. Brian Gutman is with the Education Trust Midwest, which is a nonpartisan think tank that's based in Royal Oak. Here with us now to break down the results. Brian, it's the third round of M-STEP scores. Are we finally getting a better idea how our kids are performing?
Well, we are. It takes about 3 years of data, of consistent data, to really be able to see the trends. And that's one of the really bright spots of this year. We finally have that data to get a better sense of where our students are so that we can build on that progress.
So let's start with encouraging news with the M-STEP results. What can educators point to and give us all a thumbs up?
Well, I don't know if it's quite all a thumbs up, okay. But the thing that really jumps out to me is that pretty much across the board, and this is for all students as well as groups of students, we're seeing the needle moving in the right direction in math. We're not where we need to go. We're far from it. But we're seeing improvements in almost every group, in almost every grade in math. And that's something that we should be celebrating and we should be building on.
How'd we do in social studies?
Well, in social studies, we also saw some progress. Social studies and science, we saw some progress. Our scores are still below where they need to be. But I think that the real story is in English language arts.
Yes. Now, here's where we have to talk about English language arts. State Superintendent Brian Whiston called these scores disappointing. And what, fewer than half of Michigan's third graders passed the English language arts test?
Yes. And what's even more troubling is that we're seeing scores go in the wrong direction in English language arts almost across the board. There are a couple of grades where we're seeing improvement. And again, that's good. Mm-hmm. But almost across, all the way across the board, we're seeing drops in English language arts, and less than half of our students are proficient.
So what is happening when you stop and you realize here we are in our state, Michigan's been putting more attention and mm-hmm. more money, what, nearly $80 million since fiscal year 2015-2016 on early literacy, and then you see these dismal English language arts scores?
Well, one of the things that we really need to be doing is digging deep into the data, not just the M-STEP data, but really understanding what programs are out there. When we're investing $80 million, what are we investing it in? Where is it is it moving the needle? There are absolutely bright spots around the state. There are absolutely districts that are doing terrific things for groups of students from all backgrounds. We need to be doing a better job of understanding what is going on in those schools and in those districts so that we can replicate that for more students statewide. We also should be looking to other states. In most subject areas, in most grades, Michigan underperforms the vast majority of the country. So when 45 states are doing better than us in any given subject area, what are they doing that's working? And how can we bring that to Michigan students?
And Superintendent Whiston has been very clear. He wants to make Michigan a top 10 education state within 10 years. And it's these third graders, where fewer mm-hmm. than half of them pass the English test, that are going to be the ones kind of in the eye of the hurricane doing that.
Right. Well, and I'd point out, it's true, just over 44% of third graders this year tested proficient in English language arts, reading and writing. We also have really large gaps. We have large gaps across the board. But while 44% of students statewide were proficient, fewer than 1 in 5 African American students were proficient. Only about 1/3 of Latino and low-income students were proficient, and 19.6% of students with disabilities were proficient. We need to be doing a better job of serving our kids across the board, across subject areas, and across grades.
And I guess it does take dissection, like really getting down in almost into the classroom level, doesn't it, to see what's working, which the M-STEP does not tell us.
Correct.
Here's the results. I mean, what should we make of this M-STEP?
Well, first of all, I think that we you're right in your lead-in. We now have 3 years of consistent data. Now isn't the time to start rehashing old conversations.
You mean the conversations that are happening now in Lansing perhaps we need to find another exam to replace the M-STEP.
Right. We're 3 years in. We've just got the first for the first time in many years, we've really got usable data that's valid, that's reliable. We need to be staying the course with M-STEP so that we can adequately measure what our progress looks like over the next several years and make better policy and practice decisions off of that data. We also really need to build on this progress, digging deep into what's working in schools and communities across the state so that we can replicate those, taking a look outside of Michigan to better understand what's working so well elsewhere, why some states are seeing tremendous growth while other states like Michigan are largely staying flat or moving in the wrong direction.
You know, you look at these disappointing results are we talking still kids getting used to M-STEP? Are we talking problems with the curriculum? Are we talking problems with teaching techniques?
Well, education is a complicated area. If this were an easy problem to solve, it certainly would have been already resolved. It's true there's an adjustment to any new test. That's one more reason why we shouldn't be changing again. We need consistency in the classroom. We need consistency around our standards. We need to be, again, building on our progress and moving the needle forward rather than having the conversations of yesterday. There are places in the state that have terrific curriculum that's robust and aligned. There are places in the state where teachers have tremendous support from their administrators, from their central office. There are other places where that's not quite as true. We need to make sure that our teachers are well supported so that they can help students adjust to a rigorous academic expectation and an assessment that aligns to that. We also need to make sure that we're moving forward with thoughtful, meaningful, and honest accountability. One thing that we get from this assessment is an honest snapshot of how our students are doing in each grade and each subject area. The state over the last 18 months has worked on a new education plan, and unfortunately, that plan doesn't commit to robust accountability for schools. We aren't prioritizing what we really need schools to be focusing on. And we're not going to do a great job of communicating that to parents in a way that is honest and robust and transparent and meaningful. Once again, we need consistency in our classrooms. We've got a rigorous assessment. We've got an assessment that's providing honest data. Now's time to move forward, not move backwards.
Brian Gutman with the Education Trust Midwest. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian.
Thank you.
Battle Creek mom Lori Truex and her husband didn't have the money to pay their daughter's Michigan State University tuition. So Lori spent her summer standing on the side of the street, panhandling, asking for donations. And 79 days later, she was able to end her campaign, which she called One Mom, One Year. Lori Truex is here with us. Now, Lori, how much did you ultimately raise between being on the street panhandling and the GoFundMe campaign?
Well, the numbers tend to be a little fluid right now. I can tell you as of August 26th, there was a total of $10,272.30.
Why did you take this step, this idea of, basically panhandling, standing out there?
It was absolutely panhandling. It's those crazy middle of the night, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Thoughts that run through your head. And I don't know. I guess desperation is the short answer.
Moms are going to do what moms have to do.
Exactly. And we told her, all through high school, she set this goal of keeping a 4.0. And we kept telling her, we'll take care of the other. You focus on school. And then when she graduated in 2015, two of our districts here in Battle Creek, they have free college tuition at our local community college. And we didn't tell her no, but we told her not now. Mm. We needed her to take advantage of that. That got us an extra 2 years. We honestly thought we would, you know, would be better positioned.
What does it say, Lori, about the affordability of college for a hardworking family? You know, here you are, you're working hard as a school bus driver, and you had to go to this extreme to get your daughter into the doors at MSU.
You know, she got herself in the door. It was just making that payment. My husband, he's worked 31 years in the same job. He works in a factory. We listened to them when our older daughter graduated in 2007. We didn't rob from his retirement. And then the economy tanked 08, 09, and most of his retirement was gone. And had we used it, at least we would be debt-free from one child. And, you know, so we listened to the experts. Well, that wasn't going to be an option this time. We have $60,000 in Parent PLUS loans. Do we regret it? No, we do not. My daughter has a wonderful career, and she wouldn't have that without having had that college degree.
And you want Kendall, your next daughter, to have that same opportunity.
Exactly. Don't you always want your kids to do better than you've done? And we live paycheck to paycheck, basically.
Would you do this again?
I would. I'm not going to regret one single moment of the summer, although I do think I skated a little bit easier than Kendall did. I am not on Facebook, but everybody loves to show me all the negative comments on there.
What kind of negative comments?
There are a lot of negative comments. A lot of people don't agree with us. A lot of our family members don't agree with us, and that's okay. They're not on the same path we're on. And, you know, I think when people are angry about this, you have to ask yourself, I think I'm a fairly average, typical, middle-income working mom. And if it can drive me to do something like this, isn't there a bigger issue?
Lori Truex, thank you very much for sharing your story with us with your One Mom, One Ear campaign.
Thank you.
And to hear an extended version of my conversation with Lori, in which she talks more in depth about what it takes for a working class family to pay for college, just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More than 300,000 vulnerable people in Michigan depend on public mental health care. Their needs must not be forgotten as the state wrestles with the question of who should control and deliver that care, whether mental health funding will be taken away from community mental health groups and transferred to private insurers and Michigan's Medicaid health plans. Tom Watkins has played a vital role in delivering services for people struggling with mental health issues, substance abuse disorders, and developmental disabilities. Among many positions, he was director of the State Department of Mental Health under Governor Blanchard. For the past 4 years, he's directed the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. But this week, he is stepping down, having chosen not to renew his contract. Tom Watkins, welcome. And as you look out over the state's mental health care landscape, what's working well right now, both for people and for budgets?
Well, one of the things is our public mental health system is doing great things, has need for improvement. We need to continue to invest in it. We have to decide if we really are going to allow our jails and our prisons to become the de facto psychiatric facilities, which they have been in this state and across the nation. There's some task forces that are looking at that right now. But the prison system now pays $99,000 a year for a person with mental illness that may have violated law. And we have to ask ourselves, which came first? If we would have provided the appropriate care for that individual in our community, and if we would have funded those programs appropriately, perhaps that person wouldn't be sitting in a county jail or in our state prisons. And so I commend Speaker Leonard. Tom Leonard has put together a task force to look at this issue. But we have to understand that policies we made in the past have a way of catching up with this. And when we close a number of state facilities in the 90s and then don't hold our private hospitals accountable for truly serving people with serious mental illness in their community, we're going to have some problems.
So that public policy that looks good on the surface, such as the decision by the Engler administration to close so many of those state mental health hospitals, might look good on the surface and then can extract.
Well, the follow-through has to be there. I mean, and one, I found it kind of fascinating today because we're talking about integration of care. And clearly that makes sense. I mean, because how do you separate your behavioral health, your mental health, your substance abuse needs from your physical health? I mean, we're one body, one soul.
So those, you believe, totally need to be integrated
absolutely
into a single delivery system.
The question is not if. The question is how and when. What values are going to drive those decisions? But if we say that we're going to integrate care and then allow local community hospitals to say we don't have any room at the inn if you're mentally ill. I mean, can you imagine a hospital saying, no, 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 we can't take you. Your heart attack is too severe. That doesn't happen. So I think we have to be consistent in our ideology, in our policies, and our enforcement. If we're truly going to be about integrating care, we need to do it across the system, or we're going to end up the old pay me now or pay me later. And we're paying big time in terms of loss of human dignity and putting people in prison that really need a mental health facility.
As you led the transition from what had been the Wayne County Community Mental Health Agency over to the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, you say your guiding principle has been put the patient and client first in everything, even cost cutting and budget efficiencies?
Well, you have to. When I was state superintendent, I had a yardstick that I used to guide us. And on the yardstick, it said, show me how this helps a teacher teach and a child learn. The Michigan Department of Education decision-making ruler. Everything we do should be about helping teachers teach and children learn. And the public mental health system, and this is by listening to consumers themselves, listening to people that work in the system, we came down with the mantra that we are going to be consumer and community-focused, data-driven, and evidence-based in all we do. So, you know, tell me you know local politician that or the like. It's nice that you know them. I know them too. The question is are you investing the resources in serving some of the most vulnerable people in our community? Remembering all the time, it's not those people. These are our friends, our neighbors, our mothers, our fathers, our sisters, our brothers that are deserving of being treated with dignity and respect and getting the care that we would want for somebody we love.
That stigma is still a very, as much as it's talked about, it's still a problem.
It's still a problem. We need to break it down because you're not weak because you're depressed. It's an illness. It's a disease just like high blood pressure or medical problem, heart attack or the like, and we need to break that down. Our U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow has just been fantastic on that issue, as well as Brian Kelly, Lieutenant Governor, to try to work with us to address those concerns.
When you look around the state, both on the ground level where you've been working in Detroit and Wayne County and at the state level, is that not happening everywhere? I mean, how and where are we falling short of putting the patient and the client first?
Well, I think that there is. I mean, one of the concerns that I have when we talk about transferring the resources, $2.6 billion of yours and my tax dollars from the public mental health system, which is open, where people can come and do come and challenge the decisions we're making with their money. When you transfer that over to the private profit-making system, you're not going to get past the security guard at the building where they're operated. So do we have a system of care that is truly open, accessible, and transparent? Are we making decisions that are about a consumer and community-focused, data-driven, and evidence-based? Are we making decisions based on the bottom line? And the bottom line, not to be critical, their job is to return dollars to their shareholders. It's to make profit for the company. But that profit shouldn't come out of the human decency and human care. And I think the people of the state of Michigan want to assure that the dollars are going not to make somebody rich, but to enrich the lives of the people we have a responsibility to serve.
So to this point of, as you say, you believe the physical and the mental health care should not stand as separate entities. So then who should control the system? Should the mental health services remain in the control of public entities like community mental health centers? Or should these private insurance companies take the lead?
Absolutely, we should take the lead, and we should meld. I mean, there's a lot of good things.
So private insurance companies should?
No. What I would see, and we've laid forth a plan, where rather than turning the public over to the private, we're saying to the privates, we'd like you to join us. We want to drive the vision, the value. We want to make sure that what we do well is driving the process. but also understanding that they're not the enemy. They have a place in the system, and maybe they do utilization management better or credentialing better than us. Maybe their IT system, because they've been able to invest in it, are better. So let's take a look at how we can blend the system that takes into account the vision, the values, the commitment, the over 50 years of history that the public mental health system has served people and served them well.
So not all or nothing.
It doesn't have to be all or nothing. And that's, you know, the part in the political process. We can work together to solve problems. It doesn't have to be you lose, we win. We can make this a win-win for the persons that we're supposed to serve.
What does concern you most about the direction that the state does seem to be going in letting these private health insurance companies have more control over the public mental health system? What are your biggest worries?
Well, it's worries, and it's not without merit. I mean, if you take a look at what's happened around the country, is they come in, they take the profit out, and when the profit is no more, and we're seeing this happen now, they leave town. Well, they leave town, but the family member with a serious mental illness, the child with an intellectual developmental disability, the person with substance use disorder, they don't get to leave town. They're still here. And so we have to be very, very cautious and implore the legislature as they make these decisions to act as though their decision was going to impact somebody they love, because ultimately it will. I mean, mental illness doesn't skip any zip code, nor does substance abuse, and very few people are going to get through this life without having somebody they care deeply about. And it doesn't matter how great of insurance you have. If your child is born with an intellectual and developmental disability, you're going to need some help. You're going to need some support. And that's what we should be all about.
Tom Watkins, thanks for spending time with us today on Stateside.
It's really great to be with you. Thank you so much.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
Parents and students are getting themselves ready for school to start next week after Labor Day, which can mean last-minute shopping trips for supplies and clothes and perhaps a doctor's appointment to get those vaccines up to date before the school year starts. Now, let's go back to the 1930s. 6,000 deaths a year, 95% of which were children aged 5 and under. That was the annual damage pertussis, better known as whooping cough, did in the United States in the 1930s. But three Michigan women were about to change all of that. It's Wednesday, time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And with us today is Mark Harvey from the Michigan History Center. So, Mark, these statistics from the 1930s point to a pretty grim public health problem with whooping cough before the 1940s.
Yeah, it was worse than scarlet fever, diphtheria, and measles. It was a real problem.
And it's something I suspect that parents were very afraid of.
Yeah. So vaccines have been around for a long time, as it turns out, in the U.S. all the way back to the 1720s. Cotton Mather learned about applying a little bit of smallpox on your skin to ward off future infection. So it's been around a long time. But the key is, they knew about the concept of vaccines, and Pasteur sort of refined it in the 1880s, but what no one ever really knew is how to do it on a large scale effectively and safely. So there was always this fear about applying the vaccine and what would happen. You sort of hold your breath and hope for the best. It was never standardized.
So enter Doctors Pearl Kendrick and Grace Eldering. Tell us about them. Where were they from and just who were they?
Pearl Kendrick came on the scene first. She was originally from Wheaton, Illinois, and got a bachelor's of science at Syracuse University in 1914, which is fairly unusual for women in science at that time. And she worked in New York public health agencies for a little while. And then an official with the Michigan Department of Public Health, Cy Young, not that Cy Young of baseball fame, the other Cy Young, recruited her. So imagine in 1920, this person recruiting a woman in science to come work for the Michigan Public Health Department in Grand Rapids. And he would sweeten the offer and say, you know, we're going to make it interesting for you to come here and work in Michigan. And he did. He offered employees the ability to get advanced degrees, do their own research. So Kendrick actually was able to go on while working for Michigan Department of Public Health and get her PhD from Johns Hopkins University.
That was very forward-thinking. So Grace Eldering, how did she come into the picture?
So 1920s, there's a lot of research on culturing bacteria. Michigan was leading the way in bacterial research, so they put a call out for more. They needed more people in the lab. So Grace came from Montana in 1928 per the call for more lab technicians. So she came to Lansing and was working in the lab doing bacterial culturing, and was quickly, within about 6 months, was recognized by Pearl Kendrick as someone that was outstanding, and she recruited her over to Grand Rapids, and then they started working together.
And how did they get pulled into this effort to wipe out whooping cough?
Kendrick was really inspired by those statistics that you had mentioned and wanting to do something about it, and Eldering had actually had whooping cough as a child. So those two things together crystallized their resolve to try to do something about the whooping cough. And no one, frankly, no one else had figured it out yet. So there was this kernel of them doing that.
What is it that they needed to do to kind of crack the nut, if you will?
In researching it, vaccinations, you have to find a really virulent strain of the bacteria to use for the vaccine. And they really had to do lots of lab work trying to find that very particular strain of Bordetella pertussis to use for their trials.
And at that, we cue a lab technician by the name of Loni Clinton Gordon. What is her story?
She's an African-American woman, came from Arkansas, was a dietitian, sort of bounced around from different jobs in mental facilities and other hospitals, and not surprisingly faced lots of discrimination, not just because of her race, but because of her gender, and wound up working in Grand Rapids. And again, prescient Pearl Kendrick saw her and recruited her in the lab. And what she got from Gordon is this tireless, dedicated lab technician that just did not give up until she found the perfect strain of the pertussis bacteria that they could use in the trials.
And then they began, what, doing inoculations of kids in West Michigan?
They first started by presenting the findings of their research to the American Public Health Association in October of 1935. You know, as I've read it, members were skeptical, quote unquote. Read between the lines. Here are two women presenting at a national conference, presenting a solution that no one else has come up with before, and everyone was skeptical. So being very smart and very political, both of them, Kendrick and Elderling, went back to, because actually Elderling went to Johns Hopkins as well and got a PhD in epidemiology. They went back to their mentor, Wade Hampton Frost, and got him to be their consultant on their trials. So now they had sort of the weight of Johns Hopkins staff, and they started this broad partnership with all different agencies in Grand Rapids. So public schools, women's clubs, parent-teacher associations, private physicians, you name it, county welfare relief agencies. They were smart enough to do this really broad partnership-based trial. And in 1936, they began those trials, which lasted around 2 years.
So we really saw kind of a unified effort between these three researchers in West Michigan and Johns Hopkins, you know, the medical establishment there, working together. And ultimately, they produced the whooping cough vaccine.
They did. And an interesting footnote is they were running out of funding in 1938, and they invited Eleanor Roosevelt to Grand Rapids to visit the lab and go over their work. And she was so impressed, she went back and immediately got them WPA staffers to help in the lab and secured more WPA funding to continue the research, which then later led to the National Institutes of Health funding their research and really set up Michigan as a public health research institution. You know, they funded public health research through the early 1980s.
But at what point did the state of Michigan put its official stamp on it, begin producing and distributing the vaccine?
In the 1940s. Yeah, it took a while for the trials to be proven and approved. So, you know, by the 1950s, it was standardized.
And it was actually Kendrick and Eldering who combined the shots, didn't they, into what we know as the DPT, diphtheria, whooping cough, pertussis, and tetanus.
Yep, which we still have today.
Which we still have today. And ultimately, what did that vaccine mean in terms of incidence and deaths?
What it ultimately did was a couple of things. It clearly lowered the incidence of infant and early childhood deaths. And it also, over time, gave people that surety that they could go get vaccinated and it wouldn't be rolling the dice like it was, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. There was just more science behind it. There were decades of trials behind it. And so you had that surety that this is going to work and it's going to protect my family.
How does this story of the pertussis vaccine kind of fit into the modern vaccine debate?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because a lot of the current debate is that vaccines aren't safe. And, you know, we're going on 100 years of research behind the application of vaccines in mass. So as far as a historian's long view, I'm not entirely clear what it means. I think it means that sometimes there's a subjective truth when it comes to medicine, unfortunately. And I think what we should take away from this is these were women that were concerned about people's health, children's health, and worked tirelessly to figure out a way to safely protect them from things like whooping cough.
That's the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey. And thank you so much, Mark, for sharing the story of the three Michigan women who developed that pertussis vaccine, one of the most important life-saving developments in public health history. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's fruit growers are coming up on a crucial time of the year, harvest time. With the current national climate about immigration, especially tougher ICE actions under President Trump, is that affecting farmers and their ability to get the seasonal workers they need? Are there enough farm laborers to harvest those apples? With us now is Rob Steffens. He owns Steffens Orchards in Sparta in Kent County. And Rob, it is good to have you back on Stateside.
Sure, no problem.
Remind us again, how large is your farm and what do you grow?
I'm an apple grower, about 280 acres.
My understanding is the apples ripened early this year?
We're about a week earlier than last year, but I would still say it's a kind of a normal year as far as timing-wise.
And how many workers do you need to get the harvest done the right way on your farm?
I would say we need anywhere around 40 actual pickers, and then we have support staff from there as far as tractor drivers and whatnot.
And at this point with harvest nearing, do you have enough workers?
You know, we have a smaller crop than we had last year. I think we're about maybe even 60% of what we had the year before. But I think we do. We still want everybody who came back, who worked with us last year, to come back. But we know there's some are not.
What are you hearing? Why are people not coming back?
People don't want to travel. Maybe people in the southern states that maybe used to commute are not traveling. I think some people have aged out. You know, it's too cumbersome for them, and they don't want to do that anymore. So I think there's a couple reasons for it, possibly. I think some of them maybe don't have a driver's license, unable to attain one, don't want to be accidentally pulled over for whatever reason, and then that can cause a problem for them. Just afraid to move is what I'm hearing. Afraid to put themselves at risk, you might say.
Now, have you ever had challenges in past years finding enough workers where you were concerned?
I have had some challenges, I'd say, but we have been able to keep enough workers just by word of mouth. But if it wasn't for the people that work with me now and scrambling to get some people or something, it would have been very tough. Last year, to be honest, we were on the cusp of not having enough, but we were able to sneak through.
And what about other growers? What are you hearing from them?
Well, many people have switched to the H-2A program. I'd say it's doubled, I would guess. I don't know the exact numbers, but I would say it's certainly doubled in the last couple of years. So people want a dedicated workforce and are moving to that program because they have to.
And this is, of course, the temporary work visa for foreign workers to get seasonal agricultural work in the U.S. And you're not part of that H-2A program at this point. Why not?
I'm not, because I had a very good core group of people that worked with me for a number of years. And through those people, we've been able to, you know, be able to get our crop harvested and everything done the way we wanted it to. But as I said, I think we've got people that are aging out. We got some that may not be coming back. We have absolutely zero people coming by looking for work like they used to a few years back. So it's forced these growers to go to a dedicated program, a very cumbersome program, and I think a program, quite honestly, that needs to be more liberalized so it's easier to work with. And that's the other reason why I have not gone to it.
Yeah, what are some of the problems that you feel that you just don't want to have to deal with at this point to be part of the H-2A program?
Well, they may want to make you advertise in two or three different papers to prove you can't get local labor. When they come in, you're responsible for getting them to and from a store or a bank or et cetera. You have to provide transportation. The other alternative is to go with a contractor who does all that for you. And that has worked really well for some people. But like I said, I've got a core group of people that have been with me for a long time. They're very good people, and probably my operation wouldn't be where it is without them. And so that's why I've kind of stuck with them.
Overall, Rob, what happens if you don't have enough workers?
Oh, that can be devastating. I mean, if you think about something that you've pruned the tree, you've sprayed the tree, you've fertilized the tree, you've done everything you possibly can to make that fruit as nice as it is, and then you don't have enough people to get it from the tree to into a box, it can be devastating for your storage operation, for the packing operation, for the people that sell it. It's a lose situation all the way down. It's just financially, it's going to be devastating.
And how realistic are the chances that that worst-case scenario might play out for you this year?
Being that I'm down on my crop, I'm not as concerned about that at this time because I think I may have enough labor to get by, but I'm not sure yet. If anything, we'll have to go through the churches or something to get people out of our local city, hopefully, to come out and help if we have to go to that route. And I don't know if that's possible. I've never had to do that, but came to the thought of that.
Why do you think it is such a hard sell to get Michiganders to come and help on the farms?
Well, several reasons. I think, one, you're in the elements. You're out in the wind, the cold, sometimes the rain. It's hard work. It's physical labor. And I think the kids nowadays just don't, you know, it's hard work. There's just no way around it. But it has to get done.
So just so we're very clear, how concerned are you about having enough workers for this year's crop?
Well, I'm somewhat concerned. I'd be lying if I told you I wasn't. Being that I was down, but I'm down on my crop than I was from last year. But, you know, I looked in our camp, what we have, and I still have some units that are not, don't have any people in, and we're going to be starting picking probably in about the 5th of September. So we're not very far away. And I'm kind of anticipating starting out with a two-thirds of the help that I want. But yeah, we have some people that are picking blueberries that in a couple of weeks will be joining us. So that's what we're hoping for.
Rob, what are your concerns as you think about the years to come and the immigration talk? What are you worried about as you look ahead?
I'm concerned that everything's going to get more red tape-ish, if you will. I'm concerned of the people that are around that don't have driver's licenses that need them, that that'll become a big problem for them, more of a problem than it is. I think Michigan needs to allow these people to have the ability to drive. It's solved so many problems. You know, there's 13 states that do it now. I think that's a big issue. Otherwise, you're going to be forced into going to more and more H-2A programs. And that money doesn't stay in the United States. That goes back to Mexico. It's good for as far as getting your crops picked, but as far as any of that money that you're spending, that's going back to Mexico.
Rob Steffens is the owner of Steffens Orchards in Sparta in Kent County, and we wish you a lot of luck with the apple picking season starting next week. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you.
The Michigan Farm Bureau responded to its farmer members who were frustrated with the cumbersome H-2A program. It created the Center for Commodity, Farm, and Industry Relations and the Great Lakes Ag Services. Acts as an agent for the farmer, doing the heavy lifting to get those seasonal workers under the H-2A program. Its general manager, Bob Boehm, is here with us now. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Glad to be here.
So are more farmers and growers bringing in temp and seasonal workers under the H-2A program in Michigan?
Yeah, we've seen a dramatic increase over the last 4 or 5 years.
And if my notes are correct, this year saw about 35 farmers in Michigan using the H-2A visa to bring in some 1,300 workers, most from Mexico. A few years ago, that figure was 10 farms and about 400 workers. So that's definitely on the upswing.
Yeah, it is. Those are just our numbers. The numbers for Michigan have really gone from around 340 in 2012 and 18 contracts to so far this year, 151 contracts and around 6,500 workers. Of that total, 35 farms are working with Great Lakes Ag, but there are many others that are working with other providers or with farm labor contractors, as Rob had mentioned.
So what are you hearing as you talk with farmers who are on the ground in Michigan? What are their worries and their frustrations with getting the help they need?
Well, as I said, this has been a long-term issue for Farm Bureau members, especially those with commodities that rely on hand harvest labor, a very seasonal need. Everything comes on at once in Michigan. We've got a very diverse agriculture from asparagus in the spring right on through vegetables in the summer, blueberries, apples, cherries, even into Christmas trees and pumpkins in the fall. And all of those require a big increase in hand harvest labor for those seasons when the crop is due. We have a lot of weather issues that we need to get the crops out of the field before weather impacts the quality. So historically, Michigan has had good labor housing, and we'd be able to attract migrant workers that would travel across the country and follow the crop and end up Michigan as one of the far north states. And we really saw that decline ever since 9/11, tightening border. People are aging out. Kids are going to school, finding other things to do. And people just aren't traveling like they used to. And in 2012, Michigan suffered a major freeze event, and we lost most of our fruit crops. So we didn't need labor that year, and we were concerned what was going to happen in 2013 when the crop came back strong, which it did. The workers did not return, and that became an acute issue, and that's what really pushed us to do a pilot in 2014 and then create the company in early 2015 to try to address the needs of our members.
So just basically, H2A 101, what does it do for the farmer?
Okay, well, it's a program that's been around a long time. Really, the history goes back to World War II, but it's basically one of the many visas that are available. This is the H2A for foreign workers, agricultural workers that can come in and help on a temporary basis. There's a limited number of crops that they will allow because they have to be seasonal. It can't be year-round employment. And the goal is really to bring in workers that we can't provide enough domestic workers to complete the jobs. So as Rob mentioned, you've got to do the advertising and positive recruitment before you're allowed to bring in visa workers to ensure that you've provided those job opportunities to domestic workforce first.
Rob said, and you agree, the process is cumbersome, isn't it?
Well, we work with four different government agencies. We work with the Michigan Works Office to try to, first of all, post the jobs and make sure that we've gotten those out so that people in the state or in the United States are able to have the opportunity to apply for those jobs. But then we work through a job order that details all of the information that's necessary, and you're really entering into a contract between the farmer and that employee. That employee wants to know, what are you going to pay me? What's the job? Where am I going to be housed? Is the housing inspected? All of those things are laid out in the contract so that they know when they're leaving home where they're going to be and how much money they're going to make and what the job is. That's very detailed. It gets longer and longer as you have more and more information required. So there is a complex program with this between the Department of Labor wanting to make sure that we've provided the opportunities for domestic workers, with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement to make sure that the people that we're bringing in on the visa don't present a security risk. We also want to make sure that these workers know where they're going to be going and they're transported safely through the border and on up to our farm. So we contract with a recruiting company in Mexico to locate these workers, to communicate what the jobs are. And then we also contract with a bus company, so we provide the transportation so they can get safely across the border and across the country to our farms. We also then, as a part of our service, provide bilingual translation, and we meet them when they arrive at the farm so that we can provide the training and go through the paperwork, make sure that they've got all the proper documentation that they need, so that when we leave the farmer has a folder on each employee that has the proper I-9 and all the completed information, and the worker has been trained in their own language and understands what their job and responsibilities are, and they've been introduced into their housing.
I think what you're describing between all of the government agencies involved and then all the support and help you offer sounds like it's a significant cost. What does this cost a farmer per worker?
Well, under the program, the employer is required to pay all of the travel costs, all of the visa and border crossing fees and transportation, as well as subsistence and any hotels, to get the worker up here and then also on the return once they've completed the contract. That costs probably around $1,600 per worker. And then, as Rob had indicated, the worker or the employer must provide housing. And as Rob also indicated, because these people are coming up without a vehicle, they need to have an opportunity to get to town at least once a week for groceries and banking and laundry and that type of thing. So it's not a cheap program, but these workers are here for the duration. Often we have, as I mentioned, asparagus might start in early May. Apples can go on into November. It's been difficult to get people that will commit to come for that extended period of time. They may have children in school. It gets to be a challenge to move before school might be out in Texas or Florida to come to Michigan to do that early harvest of asparagus, or likewise in the fall when school starts to get the kids back in school. It's been a problem on those bookends, and it's been more of a problem than throughout the season. So this does provide a dedicated workforce of experienced workers that can come in, do those jobs, get paid, and then they return home, and they're able to come back the following year.
How much competition are Michigan farmers facing from other states for these workers?
Michigan is one of the last states to really embrace the H-2A program. We have historically had a lot of housing here and been able to lure people here, and they'd return year after year. A lot of long-term relationships between the farmers and the employees. But it was, as I said, in 2012, it just sort of became acute that we needed to do something different. The people just weren't returning. As Rob had said, that's a common theme that we hear from our members all across the state. Other states have embraced this program much earlier. Florida, Washington State, on the East Coast, a lot of states have already gone to the H-2A program. We were one of the later ones to do it. And frankly, it was because of the perceptions that Rob and others have about the complexity of dealing through four government agencies and all of the requirements and documentation. So our role is really to make this a palatable program. The H-2A program is really the only viable program we have right now. So we're trying to work with farmers, streamline the process, be able to do enough of them that we can have some economies here and understand how to work the program and be able to do it totally within the regulations.
Bob, if you could make one change in the H-2A program to improve it or tweak it to make it more accessible to farmers, what would that be?
Well, we have a number of changes we think we could help assist this program be more productive and be a little easier to work with. We compete with countries all over the world. One close by is Canada. They have a program called their Farm Program, and it's much less costly and has more flexibility into it. The farmers here have to anticipate their labor needs 75 days before their date of need. They have to file their application. And as you know, in Michigan, the weather can change daily, and what your expectations are of your crop size and what your labor needs and how many people are going to come back and your domestic workforce really impacts that visa request. So the time frame that you have to for the lead time is really cumbersome, especially in an agricultural enterprise when you're relying on Mother Nature. So we'd like to see more flexibility in the program. We'd like to see the government agencies communicating a little bit closer together so that when there's a challenge, we've got a way of addressing that. Our goal is to have it be a good experience for everybody so that we can have workers returning year in and year out so they're experienced, they know the job, and it's much easier the second and third year, we're finding.
Bob Ames, the General Manager, Center for Commodity, Farm, and Industry Relations and the Great Lakes Ag Labor Services. Bob, thank you so much for taking us into what it takes for our Michigan growers to get the workers they need using the H-2A system.
Well, you're welcome. We appreciate the opportunity.
And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.